This is Vatican Radio. I'm Tracy McClure. The welfare of workers, and particularly of migrants, was a key issue of concern raised in a meeting Monday between Pope Francis and the Director General of the International Labor Organization, or ILO, Guy Ryder. Mr. Ryder, who was received in private audience in the Vatican by Pope Francis, shared with me some insight into what he and Pope Francis discussed.
Obviously had a wonderful encounter with Pope Francis. We discussed many of the issues which I think the Church shares concerns about with the International Labour Organization. We are very much concerned with promoting decent work in the world at the ILO. And Pope Francis spoke about the dignity of work, the importance which the Church and he personally attaches to the dignity of work and the challenges that that presents in today's world. And we talked particularly about the plight of some of the most vulnerable people in the world. And he spoke particularly about his concerns about human trafficking. And he spoke about Lampedusa and migrant workers. And we, I think, shared very much a concern that the way that the global economy is working right now does not always work in favour of those who are weakest, and that this needs to be corrected.
Did he ask you anything in particular about what the ILO could do to ameliorate the
situation?
Well,
indeed, we discussed at some length the activities of my own organisation. We have made it a point to work to protect, as I said, some of those who need it most in the world of work. And I was able to share some of the initiatives we've taken for groups such as migrant workers and another group which sometimes escapes our attention, which are domestic workers, people who work in private homes, often fall beyond the coverage of labour legislation or public attention. There are more than 50 million domestic workers in the world. The ILO has recently adopted a convention to protect their rights, and I think this was something which together we felt was a worthy area of work.
Now, as you've been saying there, the Holy See is also cooperates with the ILO in areas of justice and peace, promoting the rights of migrants and workers in all areas, particularly the maritime industry, through the Pontifical Council for Migrants especially. How has that partnership evolved, and what are the strengths of that partnership?
Yeah. Well, you're absolutely right, of course. The Church has always played a very prominent and very practical, if I can say, role in looking after seafarers in different circumstances. The ILO's own work in respect to the maritime sector took a big boost when in 2006, actually, we passed a Maritime Labour Convention, which is a sort of a small revolution, I would say, for the maritime industry, because for the first time in one document, you have, if you like, a Bill of Rights for seafarers. It's a dangerous occupation. By definition, it's an international sector. And this one Bill of Seafarers' Rights, the Maritime Labour Convention of 2006, I think, stands as a real instrument in our joint hands. And I think that the Church, together with the ILO, will be able to use it to advance the welfare of, again, a section of the workforce who really do need looking after properly.
If I'm not mistaken, in that particular convention, not many countries have signed up to it, or has that changed?
It's changed. You know, we needed 20 countries to sign up to it before it came into force, to ratify it in our language. That's now happened, and actually that's pretty quick for the ILO. And not only is it 20 countries, but they represent a very, very high proportion of the tonnage, that is to say, the overall mercantile fleet in the world. So these things take time, but in fact, by our own standards, we're advancing pretty quickly in making this convention effective, and that's very, very important.
Now, since you arrived at the helm of the ILO in, I think it was 2012, you have made Europe a priority.
Yeah.
I was reading some of the speeches that you've given in the past, and it seemed that the attention was not so much focused on Europe a few years ago. How do you hope to turn things around in Europe, where we're seeing a shocking 24% nearly of youth unemployment?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You're absolutely right. I mean, historically, for our organization, which is nearly 100 years old, Western Europe, let's leave Europe on the further side of the Berlin Wall aside, because that's a different story. But for Western Europe, the ILO was never seen as an organisation that really needed to deliver services. I think with the crisis in particular, we're now seeing a new set of circumstances in many parts of Southern Europe in particular, where the ILO needs to be present in a new way. And as you've indicated, I've made that one of the points of my period in office. I think what we need to do is to look for some new approaches in Europe. One understands, and I understand very, very well, that there is a need to restore public finances to some sort of a balance. But I do fear that the approaches taken up until this time, with the terrible social consequences they have had, you've mentioned mass youth unemployment, nearly one in four in Europe as a whole. And if you go to Greece, it's 60% of young people. In Spain, it's over 50% of people without jobs. It seems to me clearly that these are socially non-sustainable situations. So I think we want to see jobs, and particularly jobs for young people, put back at the centre of European policy. And this is going to take, I think, something of a rethink of current directions. We're working for that, and we're working to bring together governments, employers and workers. We are a tripartite organisation to try and find new ways forward. I was in Portugal just the week before last, trying to search for new directions. I regard this as a priority for our organisation.
Any suggestions there on the table? How can you cooperate with European governments?
Well, one thing which is already on the table, and it's come through the European Commission, is the notion of what is called a youth guarantee. That is to say, for all young people who are either out of education or out of work for a certain period, there should be, as a matter of right, an opportunity for further training and education or for a place in work. Sounds perhaps ambitious, sounds perhaps utopian, but it can be done. Let me take again the example of Portugal, 37% youth unemployment. We calculate that a youth guarantee scheme of this nature would cost just over 1 billion euros a year. Now, that's a major investment of public finances. Some of it will come from Europe itself, but it's best to regard it as an investment and not simply a cost, because all of the evidence shows that the cost of doing nothing for youth, the cost in terms of lost production, the cost in terms of human capital degradation, as we rather coldly call it, is much greater than the cost of the youth guarantee schemes. So we really do need to invest in our young people, and the European Youth Guarantee Scheme is certainly one way to do it.
Well, while you're talking, something is coming to mind on a personal level. My daughter is 14, and her school this year here in Italy decided to allow them to do an internship with a local company. Mm. Now, according to Italian law, I understand it's very dicey trying to give employment, even when it's not reimbursed with a salary, to young people under a certain age. Mm-hmm. Is it worth looking into new legislative options as well to allow young people, even 14, 15 years old, to do internships and things like that will prepare them for the job market?
Yeah. I think there's a few questions mixed up in all of that together. One is the clear distinction to be made between child labour, which we regard as unacceptable and a breach of human rights, and promotion of youth employment. And there are clear cut-offs between the two. And I think we have to make the distinction between the two. You know, child labour in the world is a horrible problem. There are 168 million children still in child labour. By the way, those figures have come down substantially in recent years, and we think that the ILO's own work in that area has brought the figures down by one-third, actually, since the beginning of this century. But that's one problem. The other is preparing young people for the world of work. The transition from school to work is a particularly difficult one, and many young people simply don't make that transition satisfactorily. We all know the story, don't we, of employers who demand experience of young people before they give them a job. And if you never had a job, you don't have experience. So it's a sort of a catch-22. Now, internships and apprenticeships in particular can help people out of that trap, but we do have to be careful about the conditions under which those types of schemes are operated. Internships can be great for people. My daughter's a bit older than yours. She's 20 and she's looking for her first internships. And I think it's a good thing. But we have to be careful that internships don't become simply a way for employers to get cheap or even unpaid work from young people. More and more that type of worry is being voiced around the world. So let's be careful that internships, apprenticeships really work to the benefit of the young people. Give them skills, give them experience, and prepare them for fully paid, decent work.
Now, you mentioned child labor. Also, there's the issue of human trafficking, exploitation, particularly of women and children. Many are reduced to slave labor. Now, how is the ILO working to stop such practices? You say that the figures have gone down.
Figures have gone down for child labor, down to 168 million. For forced labor, which we put at just over 20 million in the world, what I think we see is a mutation of what is a very complex phenomenon. You know, if you look at different parts of the world, you find different types of situation. Traditional, in inverted commas, forms of bonded labour, where people are born into slavery, is something we find in parts of South Asia, for example. Other forms of debt slavery, where people take on debt, they pay to get a job, and then have to be stuck in that job to endlessly try and pay off the debt. This is another problem, and we find it in all continents. And we are seeing, and this was a matter that I discussed with His Holiness this morning at some length, and he expressed profound concern about, we're seeing a growth of trafficking in human beings, moving people across frontiers or internally within countries, either for exploitation for labour purposes, sometimes for sexual exploitation. And this is, I think, quite an alarming phenomenon. To such an extent that our conference, the ILO has an annual conference next June, has an item on its agenda to talk about forced labour and to talk about particularly this phenomenon, which is a modern form, a contemporary form of slavery, very complex in many cases, which is human trafficking. These are dramatically important things. They deserve our attention. And a phrase that Pope Francis used from Lampedusa, I think, has resonated very, very clearly, certainly in my organisation. He talked about the danger of the globalisation of indifference. That is to say that we stand back, look at these phenomena, and somehow regard them as inevitable or normal in our world. And that is a reaction we must absolutely refuse and react against.
We've also seen the tragic factory fires in places such as Bangladesh, China, elsewhere in Asia, which raised, of course, the issue of the need for greater safety standards and better pay, obviously, in the work environment. Yeah. What is the ILO doing at that level?
Yes, you mentioned particularly the Bangladesh tragedy, the Rana Plaza factory collapse in April, which cost 1,100 lives. We've done two things on that. The week after the tragedy, we managed to negotiate in Bangladesh an action plan on factory fire and building safety with the government and unions and employers in Bangladesh. And we now have a project on the ground financed by the British, Canadian and Dutch governments to put that action plan into operation. It means structural inspection of factories, it means labour inspection systems, which practically did not exist in Bangladesh. It means changing the laws, the labour laws in Bangladesh, which have been defective, and it means training people. And we're doing all of that. We're also looking at the supply chain angle of all of this. You know, there are many, many international companies sourcing their international supply chains in Bangladesh, and they should take some responsibility for what happens in that country. There's been a major international initiative by international trade unions and over 100 retailers sourcing in Bangladesh, a fire building and fire safety accord in Bangladesh, which the ILO is supporting, whereby the retail companies, the household names that we know in Europe, for example, are actually taking on binding obligations to ensure the safety of the factories from which they source, and where remedial action is required, they're undertaking to pay for that remedial action. So both of these angles, the international supply chain angle and the national action by Bangladeshis themselves, seem to us to be important. We're supporting both.
These proposals would, I would imagine, would bring higher costs to the end consumer? Do you think that consumers today are willing to pay more for the goods that are produced abroad because they're paying also for the workers' safety?
Well, I think there's two parts to an answer to that question. I think consumers, by and large, do care. I think they are willing to pay. And by the way, it's a few more cents or a dollar on the price of a T-shirt in Bangladesh. I think they're willing to pay that to ensure, if they knew that that would be the price of ensuring that these articles are not being produced in death trap conditions. That's the first thing. The second thing to say is, in Bangladesh, wages are rock bottom. I mean, until this week at least, the starting wage in the Bangladeshi textile industry, ready-made garment industry, is $38 a month. It's really the rock bottom in the global supply chain. There's an agreement potentially being reached to raise that by 70%. It's just been approved by the relevant authorities in Bangladesh. That, I think, indicates to me that margins in Bangladesh are not so thin that wages and working conditions cannot be improved without eroding competitiveness. I think we really have to move forward, not only in terms of safety, but also in terms of pay. These people deserve a living wage as much as anybody else.
It might be a lot to ask consumers in an economic crisis that's gone global.
It could be. It could be. But, I mean, I think that consumers, when they're given proper information, will make their own choices. And I remain convinced, even in difficult conditions, and you're right, people don't have money in their pocket today, as they perhaps previously did. But I think when they know that a higher price, a marginally higher price, would ensure people's safety, I think they go the right way.
Last question. As the 2015 Millennium Development Deadline fast approaches, are we any closer to meeting the targets outlined in those goals where the employment is concerned?
Well, I think we all know that the scorecard for the Millennium Development Goals is a mixed scorecard. We've done pretty well on some and less well on other of the objectives. The poverty objective has actually been met, although unevenly. I think we all know that progress made in some big countries has rather tilted the balance in favour of achieving that objective. My concern has been that jobs and employment weren't actually sufficiently prominent in the Millennium Development Goals, so it's a bit difficult to answer your question. But what I would say to take advantage of the opportunity is that, you know, we're now in the process of building the development agenda post-2015, after the Millennium Development Goals have expired. And we're pushing very hard in the ILO for decent work. Don't forget, we care about the quality of work. We're pushing very hard for decent work to be included as an explicit objective of the post-2015 development agenda. That didn't happen in the Millennium Goals. But we think in this way we can do what, in a world with more than 200 million people out of work, we clearly need to do, and that is to put decent jobs at the centre of the development agenda. So post-2015, big challenge ahead of us, and it was an issue again that I discussed with Pope Francis this morning, and we're working with many Catholic NGOs, labour-related organisations. They share our concern to put decent work at the heart of the new development agenda post-2015.
Okay, maybe we should be talking again after 2015.
With pleasure, with pleasure.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.